this year's World Happiness Report came out. And this is a report. It's a partnership of Gallup, the Oxford Wellbeing Research Center, and a UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. And they bring it out every year, and they go out and they ask about 1,000 people, I think, in each country whether they're happy. And this year, for the first time, the United States fell out of the top 20 people, mostly because our young people are severely unhappy. And I'll be talking later on, as I said, with Abigail Schreier, who's written this book about bad therapy, who makes some suggestions about why our young people are so unhappy. But this goes along with the fact that, by the way, I was looking at this, and I'm sure the survey was probably taken before October 7th, but the young people in Israel, are number two in happiness, right? Because number one, I think, was, I can't remember, Latvia, I think, was number one, and number two, the young people in Israel are the happiest, and there's a country that's constantly under existential threat, but they believe in something, and the threat hones them and grounds them to reality. Now, the report doesn't ask people much about why they're happy, which means that each news outlet, and I looked up a bunch of the story in a bunch of different news outlets, each one reports the prejudice of the news outlet, right? So that the left says, well, they're not happy because these other countries like Finland, which is always listed among the happiest places. Oh, who could tell? It's so dark there. But Finland is always listed as among the happiest places. They say, well, a lot of government services. They have a lot of government services. Yeah, that's true. But it's also true they're a kind of, you know, homogenized, if that's the word I want. You know, they have a lot of homogeneity in their culture, and maybe that's it. So you don't know. So everybody imposes the reason people are happy on them. You know, on the conservatives, they'll say, well, it's marriage and sex and all this stuff. And because happiness is self-reported, we don't even know how accurate this is. And the funny thing is, at any given moment, you're unhappy, right? At any given moment, I was just, you know, Abigail Schreier writes about this too. At any given moment, you're worried about what's happening, your job, whether I'm going to get this right. Can I do this thing now? I don't have my show map in front of me. Can I actually do this show? You know, you're always worried about something. So it's really hard to know whether a country is happy or not. But we know that the deaths of despair, especially among middle-aged white men, have skyrocketed. With deaths of despair, or what they call drug use and suicide and alcohol use and all this stuff, went down a little bit, those drug deaths of despair during the Trump administration when jobs became plentiful. But of course, they've gone back up over this. But so I'm very wary when I read about the reports on this, why people are unhappy. You know, people in this business are ambitious people. And they want you to get what you want. You are paying for the product, which is me talking, which is our opinions. And so we want to give you the opinions that make you want to pay for them. And the opinions that make you want to pay for them are the opinions that you agree with. And so that's why you hear a lot of people confirming your opinions on TV, because they want you to love it. I'm the exception because, as you know, I'm on a mission from God. And I want you to love me, but because I love you, I feel that I have to really tell you what I believe to be the truth. And it's not that offensive, actually. We are in a weird, weird situation in this country. Have you ever had a friend who's either been through or is going through some tremendous, traumatic situation, like death or a divorce, or, you know, their spouse cheated on them, or they've been assaulted in some way, and they're talking to you about how unhappy they are, but they can't figure out why? You've probably seen that thing. I think I brought in a little piece of it. Yeah, the girl with a nail in her head, right? There's a girl talking to her boyfriend, and she has a nail stuck in her forehead. Play this.
It's just, there's all this pressure, you know? And sometimes it feels like it's right up on me, and I can just feel it, like literally feel it in my head, and it's relentless, and I don't know if it's going to stop. I mean, that's the thing that scares me the most, is that I don't know if it's ever going to stop.
Yeah. Well, you do have a nail in your head.
It is not about the nail.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, I'll bet if we got that out of there...
Stop trying to fix it.
No, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm just pointing out that maybe the nail is causing...
You always do this.
I love that. I think it's a hilarious video. Stop trying to fix it is my favorite line. I always say, you know, to my wife, if you want somebody to listen to your problems and not fix them, talk to your girlfriends. Mrs. Hot Gandalf loves when I say that. Right this minute, this is true. People don't want to talk about the pandemic. And when people, you know, in the business talk to you, they say, don't talk about the pandemic because you will lose audience. People will tune you out. They don't want to hear it. It was traumatic. They want to leave it behind. It's gone. It's finished. It's over. But here's the thing, okay? There's a book, one of my favorite. I love this book by Winston Churchill. It's called My Early Life. They sometimes publish it as Young Winston because they made it into a kind of second-rate movie. The book, though, is great. That guy, every single thing that could happen to somebody happened to him in his young life. He was in the last major cavalry charge at, I think it was called Omdurman. He was fighting the Mas, the Islamist threat there. And he had to escape from prison under gunfire. It's just an amazing, amazing story. But one of the things he says, and I'm quoting from memory because I couldn't find the book on my shelf, but one of the things he talks about is that he was at the highest levels of the British government and of the European government. And he says he was at parties with all the great leaders of Europe before World War I. And he was at parties with all the great leaders of Europe after World War I. And they were all different people. They were all different leaders. Why? Because they had destroyed their civilization. World War I was the beginning of the end of Europe. Europe's great civilization was 1500 with the Reformation to 1914, and then it was done. It was just World War I, then World War II, then Europe was a memory. That civilization was gone. No Sistine Chapels coming out of Europe, no Shakespeare coming out of Europe after World War II. And that was because of the decisions people made to wander into this meaningless, useless war with the idea that it was going to be over in a couple of weeks and a generation of men was wiped out. And that was something that they could just never recover from. And of course, Germany was forced into penury and the penuries made them think that Hitler would be a great idea. And World War II destroyed them all. The greatest civilization in human history gone because of bad, stupid, useless decisions. When leadership screws up at that titanic level, what do? You toss them out. There should be consequences. Well, not so much. When people talk about the pandemic now, when they talk about, oh, this happened because of the pandemic, that happened because of the pandemic, they're not talking about the pandemic. They are talking about the greatest screw up by Western leadership since World War I. Trump, I'm sorry, but he was part of it. Biden, Fauci, Macron in France, the Tory party in Brooklyn, Merkel's successor in Germany. Not only, these are the same people, not only do they still hold power, their reputations among their supporters are completely intact. Here's the blog father, Glenn Reynolds. If you ever read Instapundit, his wonderful blog. He was one of the earliest great bloggers. And Glenn now writes sometimes for the New York Post. He says, the architects of the disastrous policies, figures like Fauci, Francis Collins, and Deborah Birx, escaped any reckoning. Politicians like Cuomo, Pelosi, and California Governor Gavin Newsom cheerfully flouted the rules they imposed on the little people, going to dinner parties and otherwise cavorting in defiance of social distancing and mask mandates. As left-leaning blogger Nate Silver observed, it's kind of crazy and tells you a lot about who was writing the restrictions, that churches in some jurisdictions were subject to more restrictions than museums, not just museums, and liquor stores and strip joints. The final blow came when public health experts, quote unquote, who had been condemning family Sunday dinners as inconsistently dangerous, did a 180 and endorsed massive Black Lives Matter protests on the specious ground that racism is a public health problem. Glenn says if there can't be any punishment, and in today's America, the very idea of consequences for the nomenclatura runs the risk of being called white supremacist or insurrectionist, there can at least be remembrance. The expert class blew it, sold out, or gloried in putting people under its thumb. And I would go much, much further than that. The expert class, the leadership class, the political class took everything from us. They took everything. They turned a roaring Trump economy into a mess. They stripped us of our freedoms, of our worship. They let our cities burn to the ground over the death of a thug resisting arrest. Our media lied to us and told us that the protests were mostly peaceful. Our scientists lied to us, told us we should wear masks that didn't do anything, get a vaccine that wasn't good for younger people. They stripped us of free speech in their line still. And I, you know, I'm against political violence almost always, and I'm speaking here metaphorically. But under what moral system should these people not be metaphorically tarred and feathered and thrown into the clavenless darkness where there is great wailing and gnashing of teeth? For more great stuff like that, like and subscribe. And do not forget to subscribe to The Andrew Klavan Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Warning! The root's on fire! You're about to experience the most high-octane, pedal-to-the-metal controversial show of your life. Please buckle up and hold on tightly. This station is not responsible for injuries. This is Wayne Allen Root, raw and unfiltered, with America's favorite conservative rock star, direct from the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas. What time is it? It's time for war! Here's your host, 100% raw truth, 100% American made, the warrior, Wayne Allen Root.
Lots of other stories I want to get to, almost all of them about the border, but I want to read you my latest commentary. It's entitled, "We Can All Complain About Open Borders, the Destruction of the USA, and the Crime of the Century, but I have a real immediate solution for all of it." On my TV show, America's Top 10 Countdown, on Real America's Voice TV every Saturday, I choose the top 10 stories in America as chosen by me, a lifelong conservative warrior, America first patriot, and capitalist evangelist. Then I choose the order and count these crucial stories down to number one. You need to hear this past week's number one story, because I have an immediate solution for the open border crisis that has the potential to change everything. First, I'm a man of solutions. Anyone can complain and criticize, but always bring a solution. I wrote two best-selling books about solutions for conservative patriots, The Great Patriot Protest and Boycott Book and The Great Patriot Boycott Book. I'm proud to say my last book was endorsed by President Trump. My books show conservative patriots how to boycott, punish, and defund woke liberal companies and how to reward and fund patriotic pro-American companies. Those are real strategies and solutions that work. But my favorite solution ever was born 15 years ago. Way back in the mid-2000s, I proposed a solution for open borders and illegal immigration. I urged Republican governors to round up their illegal alien lawbreakers and ship them to Democrat cities and towns. I knew that liberal politicians would scream bloody murder. This is how we could make Democrats look like fools and hypocrites. And if we overwhelmed their cities and made their lives miserable, they might act. Fast forward to today. GOP governors like Florida's Ron DeSantis and Texas's Greg Abbott are sending illegal aliens to Democrat cities. And those hypocritical so-called sanctuary cities are screaming bloody murder and crying uncle. They are overwhelmed. Their budgets are exploding. Their streets are swarming with crime, drugs, and homeless. Liberal hypocrites are losing their minds. We've created chaos and crisis by taking a page from Saul Alinsky's playbook. And we've overwhelmed Democrat cities by taking a page from Cloward Piven, who said overwhelm the system. So how could we apply this strategy to open borders? How do we destroy Bud Light? We stopped trying to boycott many different woke companies. We all got together and boycotted one company. Every conservative in America said no more Bud Light. And we won bigly. Corporate America was stunned. Never before had all of us stuck together with such purpose and passion for such a long period of time to defeat and destroy one woke company. Now let's apply that strategy to the open border and illegal immigration. Obviously, the best way to secure our borders is to elect President Trump in November, finish and strengthen the wall, reapply Title 42, stay in Mexico, hire 86,000 new border agents instead of 86,000 new IRS agents, fly thousands of drones over the border to work with Border Patrol to make our border impassable, ban birthright citizenship. Most importantly, Trump must deport 20 to 30 million illegals who entered during Biden's presidency and end welfare as we know it for all illegal aliens. Without welfare, no one will come. Without welfare, they'll all go home. We also need to end the count of illegals for the census. And we need to make it a felony for illegals to vote. Simple, right? Except none of this can happen till President Trump is sworn in as the 47th president of the United States on January 20th, 2025. Until then, nothing is going to happen. So here's my idea to force action now. We copy the Bud Light strategy and apply it to open borders on steroids. Republican governors need to stop sending their illegal aliens to so many different Democrat cities. I know this was my idea in the first place, but I'm telling you, I've now updated it. Stop sending them to New York, Boston, Chicago, and even Martha's Vineyard. Instead, we all work together. We all row the boat in the same direction. We all aim at the same target to overwhelm the system, just like Cloward Piven, to create chaos and crisis, just like Saul Alinsky. Every GOP governor needs to send every illegal alien to one city only, Washington, D.C. Biden has let in millions of illegals. Send them all to one place. Make Washington, D.C. collapse. Overwhelm Washington, D.C. Surround the White House with illegals. Surround the Capitol building with illegals. Surround the Supreme Court with illegals. Surround the neighborhoods of key senators and congressmen with illegals. Surround the neighborhoods of the Supreme Court justices with illegals. Surround the schools of the spoiled brat children of senators and congressmen and Supreme Court justices with illegals. Surround the fancy restaurants where congressmen meet for lunch with lobbyists and sell out our country. Fill them with illegals. Make congressmen step over hordes of illegals to walk into Congress each day. Make senators step over hordes of illegals to get into their Senate chambers. Make Supreme Court justices step over hordes of illegals to get into the Supreme Court. Surround the White House. Make it difficult for Biden's motorcade to get in or get out. Surround Obama's D.C. mansion. Make it impossible to get in and out of Obama's neighborhood. Make the spouses of senators and congressmen step over dangerous illegals to get into their favorite supermarkets, hair salons, nail salons, gyms, department stores. Make the children of the most powerful leaders in D.C. step over illegals to get into their fancy private schools. Overwhelm D.C. until it's one gigantic gridlock with illegals. Forget New York or Boston or Chicago or Martha's Vineyard. Everyone needs to aim at one target from now till January 20th, 2025, just like we all aimed at Bud Light. This is how we make Democrats in D.C. feel the pain. This is how we make their lives miserable. This is how we make these hypocrites scream bloody murder and cry uncle. My guess is they will actually do something about open borders just to return their own lives to normal, just to save their own marriages, just to keep their own children safe. But if I'm wrong and they still refuse to act, at least we will have the satisfaction of knowing we made their lives miserable. So there's my idea. I'm always coming up with ideas. I think it's a great one. I've seen the reaction in chat rooms. I've seen the reaction at conservative websites where I posted this idea today. Everybody loves it. It's a great idea. You know, it's just like Bud Light. We all got together and we aimed our cannons at one company, Bud Light, and we destroyed them. We wiped them off the face of the earth to the point where everybody involved was fired. And I'm telling you, we can do the same thing with illegals if every Republican governor ships their illegals to one city, Washington, D.C. Fill Washington, D.C. with millions of illegals. Remember, New York City's been destroyed. Just destroyed. And do you know New York City's been destroyed? With just like 200,000 illegals. I think they've gotten 200,000 illegals in 3 years, and the whole city's teetering on bankruptcy. Can you imagine if we shipped a million or 2 million or 3 million to Washington, D.C.? I see the emails coming in already. All my fans are saying, yeah, yeah, exclamation point. Hammer Washington, D.C. We will. I would. I'm sure Trump would. I don't know if any of them have the balls to do it. I guess DeSantis would. I'm not sure about Abbott, but maybe Abbott would. But other than Abbott and DeSantis, have there even been any other GOP governors to bus and fly all their illegals to Democrat cities. So we can only do this if everyone cooperates. Hammer Washington, D.C. Make them cry uncle. I'm Wayne Allyn Root. RootForAmerica.com. WayneRoot@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Wayne Allyn Root, and I have the... All right, Wayne Allyn Root, trying to do this kind of a strange way because I have no audio. I cannot hear anybody at my Dallas studio, so everyone hears me, but I can't hear you. So they're giving me counts via text on my cell phone, which is in front of me, and I'll just have to try my best to do the show where I can hear absolutely nothing from the studio. No idea what's going on, no idea why, but we have lost contact, lost sound with Dallas, but everyone can hear me. That's the good news. So big news that they haven't gotten to yet. Kamala Harris gets humiliated in Puerto Rico. A video shows Vice President Kamala Harris clapping along with a song during her visit to Puerto Rico, like a clapping moron puppet being told. And then one of her aides leans over and tells her the song is a protest against her. She's brutally trolled by protesters in Puerto Rico singing a protest song against her as she mindlessly claps like a seal and dances along. And then you watch carefully for the awkward moment when her aide, who speaks Spanish, has to reality check her and she suddenly stops clapping. Let me see if I have some words from the song. Hold on a second. Her motorcade was confronted by dozens of loud protesters, one of whom held a sign saying Kamala Harris, war criminal. Unable to take the hint, she then reacted to a group of musicians thinking they were welcoming her. And after clapping and smiling inanely and dancing to the music, she was informed by her aide that the musicians were singing, "We want you to know, Kamala, what did you come here for? Long live free Palestine and Haiti too. We want to know what you think of the colony." And that was kind of the end of it. That was the story. So... That's Kamala Harris for you. She is just a moron. I put out a tweet moments ago, and I want you to hear what I put out. I put out the following tweet. Forget all the other disasters that threaten to destroy the USA. Open borders, welfare spending on illegals, green energy boondoggle, rigged elections, unimaginable crime wave, national debt, DEI, ESG, CRT, transgender brainwashing, all terrible. But my bills keep going way up, 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 up. Every month, inflation is exploding. Any government figures that say otherwise are lies, fraud, propaganda, and gaslighting. My bills going so high, I don't know what to do or say. No matter how much money I make, and I work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I'm the hardest worker you've ever seen. And I'm an incredible earner. I know how to make money. And money is pouring in. I'm making the most money of my life. And I still can't keep up with any of my bills. This is insane. This is a communist plan to murder the middle class. Only the super wealthy can survive this hyperinflation on everything. And just as I write that, I see the following article. Why auto insurance rates are skyrocketing in the United States. The average annual premium for full coverage auto insurance rose to $2,543 a year. I mean, that's the average. That means there's a lot of people who pay tremendously more. And you got to realize there's a lot of little cars on the road, junky cars on the road, used cars on the road, and yet $2,543 is the average car insurance, up 26% from last year, and they're trying to tell us there's no inflation. Do you know what a large chunk of the income people spend on groceries and your home shelter and home insurance and car insurance and health insurance and life insurance, and all of those are skyrocketing? And how about the payments on your car? If you're trying to buy a new car, no one's going to be able to buy a new car because you can't afford the interest rates. No one's going to be able to buy a new house because you can't afford the interest rates. But you know, and I say the biggest problem for me, car insurance, health insurance, life insurance, home insurance. They're all going through the roof. Property taxes going up. Everything's going up. Garbage bills going up. Water bills going up. Electric bills going up. Gas bill going up. You're telling me there's no inflation. You're telling me inflation has slowed. You're telling me we've beaten inflation. You're a freaking liar. It's terrible out there. And by the way, let me mention why I think auto insurance rates are skyrocketing. Okay, because this article is full of crap. This article says it's because of repair times and expensive rental car costs. That's not why car insurance is exploding. Car insurance is exploding because of illegal aliens. They're all over the roads of every major city, in particular here in the Southwest and the West. You know, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, San Jose, my town, Las Vegas, Reno, Salt Lake City's filled with illegals, Phoenix, Tucson, filled with illegals. They're all filled with illegals. All right, we're on the way out. All right, so I mean, I continue to believe the biggest issue in America is the open border. And the biggest issue for me personally, other than the open border, is the inflation, as I said in the last segment, that is through the roof, that never lets up, that gets worse every day. It's like the border gets worse every day. It's like the COVID vaccine deaths get worse every day, and the inflation gets worse every day, and none of them are in the news. The media, this should be on the news media every night. It should be leading off the news. COVID deaths, massive inflation, open border invasion of America, and none of them are in the news. It's unbelievable. So the Border Patrol Chief, U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens, highlighted the sheer magnitude of the ongoing border crisis under Joe Biden, revealing that people from over 160 countries have entered the country illegally this fiscal year. 160 countries. Roughly 200, this is a separate issue now, roughly 200,000 immigration deportation court cases have been dismissed after the Department of Homeland Security failed to file paperwork. 200,000 immigrants, how many of them are killers who might kill your child, your wife, rape your wife? How many of them are going to get in a car drunk and kill your whole family? How many of them are literally terrorists that are going to do another 9/11? 200,000 of them had their cases dismissed after DHS failed to file paperwork. I mean, this is what's going on in the United States of America. It is sick. It is just sick. I'm sick to my stomach over all of it. I'm Wayne Allyn-Root. We better fight, man. I'll be right back on Lindell TV on USA Radio.
Hey everybody, Peter Zine here, coming to you from Colorado. We're in the calm between the snowstorms. Got 40 inches last week. What we're going to get this weekend, 4 to 6 inches, almost seems like a rounding error in comparison. Anyway, 60 degrees because Colorado. Today we're going to talk about the revolution in military affairs that is now going through a second phase. So the first revolution in military affairs happened in the 1990s and 2000s, when the United States started to marry information technologies to its military. Combination of sensors and targeting information, whether it's on the method of delivering the ordnance or in satellite or attached to the weapon itself. So, for example, joint direct attack missions fall into that category, as do cruise missiles like the Tomahawk. Important stuff. And it basically took whatever explosive ordnance that you had and allowed you to deliver it to a target with a very high degree of accuracy. So instead of having to carpet bomb things like we used to in Vietnam and ages before, now you just send one or two weapons out and hit the specific target that you're at. There was talk for a good long time that if you marry precision weapons with hypersonics, that all of a sudden all of the rules of warfare go away and you can just have a handful of hypersonics to defend everything. And then we discovered things like jamming and the fact that people don't have one tank, they have 100,000 people in infantry, and the math never just worked out. Hypersonics are just way too expensive. It's not that they don't have a role to play. It's just that it's not the determining role. So that was kind of phase one. We're going through phase two now, which is the democratization of the application of these technologies. And so instead of it being controlled from the White House or from a general's chair, individual soldiers are now getting command of this sort of information, can use it to make targets on an autonomous basis. And we're seeing this, of course, most aggressively in Ukraine, mostly with drones. The Ukrainians are following a four-part strategy at the moment. I'm sure this is going to evolve quite a bit. Phase one is applying these drone technologies to things like jet skis and loading them up with a couple hundred pounds of explosives and sending them out to target Russian naval vessels. That process has been so effective, as I've noted in earlier videos, that basically the western half of the Black Sea is now completely no-go for the Russian fleet, and most of their ships, especially the larger ones, simply can't shoot back because anything that's installed on the deck of the ship is designed to hit the horizon or higher, and it can't angle down to target these small boats in the water. So that's number one. Number two is actually something that's much more recent that has come up as a result of the problems with the American Congress getting conventional aid to Ukraine. The Ukrainians have had to find a way to hold the line against the Russians when they're running out of artillery shells. And so that what they've started doing is mass producing these very small drones that only have a payload of about a pound, which is about the size of a small grenade. And when the Russians do their human wave tactics, you just send a swarm of them out to go after anything that moves. And it's basically dropping grenades at range into massed infantry. They've done this to the point that in the Battle of Avdiivka, which the Ukrainians technically lost, they were inflicting regularly 8 and 10 to 1 casualty ratios on the Russians, despite not having much artillery. So anti-personnel. Number three is mid-range infrastructure strikes. The Ukrainians developed a pair of drones called the Scythe and the Beaver. Of the two, the Beaver is far more technologically competent and has a much longer range and better avionics, whereas the Scythe is basically a garage project that's practically made out of plywood. It's a fugly little thing. Carries a decent warhead, but less range. And they've been sending these out against any pieces of infrastructure in kind of the near abroad, if you will, within a few hundred kilometers of the front line. And they've used it to target any number of things like refineries in the Russian space, but also fuel depots. And then finally, something where the Americans are getting in on the job was something called the Phoenix Ghost. Now, the Phoenix Ghost only carries a fairly small warhead, typically 5 to 15 pounds. The advantage of the Phoenix Ghost is it's modular, and you can put it together on the fly, and it's light enough that one soldier can carry it. Now, originally, when the Phoenix Ghost started coming in, they were going after armored vehicles and supply trucks. But the Ukrainians very, very quickly realized that because they were available in such small volume, and because they were so accurate, because unlike a lot of drones, these have a live visual feedback to the controller, they could basically put them in a backpack, send someone hiking or driving into Russia, and 1,000 miles from the front line, take it out, put it together, and send it against an unprotected target. And most of the refinery attacks we have seen in Ukraine in recent 2 weeks maybe, are probably Ukrainian special forces operating with American-made Phoenix Ghosts deep within the Russian interior. And this is getting pretty robust because at present, you know, we're talking about regularly 500,000 to 1 million barrels per day of Russian refining capacity is taken offline. The issue is that these things are accurate enough that they can strike within just a couple of feet of what you aim them at because you can see where you're going. And that allows the operators to target the sensitive spots in a refinery like the distillation tower where the parts that are really explodey get separated. And so if you target that bit, the parts that are really explodey get really explodey. And repairing this is very difficult for the Russians because they stopped training engineers in large number over 30 years ago. Anyway, bottom line is that you're talking about interrupting an income flow for the Russians that is typically about 8% of government revenues, which is more than what, say, the U.S. federal government as a percentage of the budget collects in terms of corporate taxes. So big line item. And if you destroy the ability of the Russians to process crude, that means there's no place for the crude to go because the pipeline system is already filled to maximum. And then you talk about pressure building back up the pipes and then having problems, everything through their midstream right up to the point of production, and they might even have to shut some in. And since they don't have the engineers to turn it back on, that would be that. Anyway, so we're getting a combination of strategic warfare, naval warfare, infantry warfare, economic warfare that didn't seem possible as little as 3 months ago, and now they're all very much in play with most of these drones 100% Ukrainian-born specials. Now, this, in my mind, evokes something very similar to what happened in the American Civil War and in the Crimean campaign of the 1850s, when you had Europeans engaging in early industrial warfare and then sending observers to watch the Americans duke it out, where they were watching the Americans engage in early to mid-industrial warfare. There's a lot of reasons for a lot of countries to now send observers into Ukraine, even if they're not providing a lot of aid, because this is a fundamentally new technological breakthrough. We understand today that the first phase of the revolution in military affairs took what was a relatively lumbering Cold War defense industry that the United States had and turned it into something with extreme range and extreme precision. We're now keeping that precision and marrying it to individual decision-making with not tens, not hundreds, but tens of thousands of individual weapons platforms that can be launched in a relatively short period of time, and they're decentralized. Now, there are pros and cons to that, but being able to have individuals target enemy formations at scale over a 1,000-mile front and then hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the front, that is something we have never seen ever in any warfare in any age, and we are only at the very beginning of understanding just how transformative that is going to be.